might get started. Thanks for coming after so many lectures this term. At the end of the term, my name is Julian Savulescu, Director of the New Hero Centre, Practical Ethics. It's a great pleasure to welcome my colleague Tim Murphy, who's the Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He has a very distinguished career in biomedical ethics, and particularly in medical ethics. He's written one of the major books in research ethics and has a long publication record. And so today we're going to hear unfinished business, the ethics and transplant waiting list. So it's a great privilege for us to have you here.
Okay, thank you.
But
Julian, my friend, tell me how long we are here first.
I think we've got it's an hour and a half we've got scheduled.
What was advertised?
One and a half.
Normally.
Okay.
Normally what we would do is sort of talk for about 40 minutes and then see how questions go. And if questions keep going, we'll
use. Okay. Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here. And my goal today is to sort of walk the line between providing some information about the transplant system in the United States and also ask some philosophical questions, too, about the ideas behind the wait list of procedures in the United States. I don't know how familiar this is to you. I will offer some introduction to it, and please feel free to ask a question as I go along. I'm happy to take questions as we go along. All right, what am I going to do here today? It's sort of a trope, sort of a reflex when talking about transplantation ethics to begin with the number of people on wait lists, and I myself am going to follow that reflex as well. Right now in the United States, there are almost 100,000 people listed waiting, identified as waiting list candidates for organs or tissues. Now, we have to have an ethical discussion already, because this number is a number. What kind of a number is this? Well, it turns out that in the United States, you can be listed twice. The country is divided up into organ procurement areas. So it's just not one national waiting list. There are multiple waiting lists identified by region. And the idea here is to balance them out so that one region uses as many organs as it produces, so that one part of the country is not sucking off all the livers or the kidneys or these kinds of things. So there are multiple, there are about, I think, 11 organ procurement areas in the United States. And if you have two homes, if you have one home in Florida and one home in New York, you can perhaps be listed twice. So the idea, of course, here is that this makes you eligible for two possible streams of organs rather than one. Right. Now the other thing, so as I said, you can have an ethical discussion about this. The other thing about this number is the fancy language here, waiting list candidates. Up until a couple of weeks ago, it used to say people waiting for organs. And I wrote a scathing review of this and sent it to a transplant journal. They rejected it, but went back and changed the language, because this number is not the number of people who are waiting for organs. In point of fact, these are the folks who are eligible for transplants, whether or not they want one. All right, so there are a lot of people, and depending on whom you believe, there may be up to a third of the number of people on this list who are not, quote, active. Namely, these are people who have decided that they want to live with dialysis or dialysis is okay, and don't, for some particular reason, want at this time to be considered eligible for a transplant. All right. So there are a lot of assumptions, a lot of caveats built into this number. The key thing about this.
Do you also have, as we have, a lot of people who aren't on the waiting list but in fact need transplants?
Well, this is another number, the folks who may not make it to the system far enough because they're poor and they're sort of living with their disease. who don't have strong advocates, who may not make it onto the list. So there is this, there is a group of these. I'm not sure how big that number is.
For instance, ours, there are age limits. You can't
put on the list. We don't have that. We don't have that. The default tends to go the other way. If you're in any way remotely eligible, it's probably better to get you on the list as soon as possible so that your chances improve. Okay? That's what we got. Now, the thing about this number is, since the advent of transplantation medicine, this number has only ever gotten bigger. All right? So this number has never gone down. It has only gone up over time. And my suspicion is that this number will only ever get bigger because of the increased eligibility for transplantation. So in other words, in the olden days, prior to AIDS, for example, at the early onset of AIDS, those people with AIDS would not consider eligible. Now, HIV infection is not an exclusion for a transplantation. So people get sicker and sicker and sicker, but medicine gets a little better and better and better, and therefore the people who can benefit from the transplant gets better. And innovations in transplantation medicine create their own lists. For example, people who can benefit from bowel transplants. And not only people, but kids, children who benefit from bowel transplants. So the technology is getting better, so the list is only going to get better, or get bigger, right? Okay, so here's what I'm going to do against that, against this background number. I want to review possible mechanisms for getting organs and tissue for transplant. What are the main ways we can get them? And I want to look at, I call them intra-system measures to reduce the waiting list. Namely, if we take the existing system as it now functions, what can we do with that system to get more organs and, I'm going to put it this way, reduce the waiting list. But I'm not going to talk today about alterations in medical criteria. Some of you may know that there's a threshold of death that's identified for being eligible for dead donor organ transplantation. And there has been discussion about changing that standard and reducing it. So that it's not brain death, properly speaking. It's a higher order thought processes death. So neocortical death. So you get more people in that category, you get more organs, you would think. I'm not going to talk about that today. I want to talk about take the system as you've got it now. What can you do with it to get more numbers? I also want to open the door to discussing, and then hopefully we can have an interesting discussion about this, to discussing one alternative approach to the existing system. And I don't want to just put that out there. I mean, you probably will know about the idea. I want to sort of look at it philosophically and say, what's the burden of proof we have to meet in order to say, yes, let's go with an alternative to this system? So that's where the more philosophical issues may come up. All right. First, this is something we have to do now in regard to disclosures. There is no big pharmaceutical company, no small biotech startup firm that is paying me to say anything in these areas. So hopefully you can trust my intellectual independence in these matters. But at least they do not, whatever their merits, my ideas do not at least have the taint of some kind of commercial sponsorship. Okay. This is I don't know what the tradition is here, but this is pro forma topic today. Okay. All right. How can we go about reducing the wait list for this big number, 100,000 people? Let's assume it's some version of that number is true. That's a pretty good mid-sized city in the United States, 100,000 people. How can we go about eliminating the wait list? One approach would be eminent domain. An eminent domain, for the legally minded among you, is familiar. This involves taking from private hands in order for public benefit. You want to put a new highway through town, you ask the people whose houses obstruct the way to close up shop and move on, and you hand them some money and thank them very much and wish them well in their new lives. There was an absolutely fascinating decision in the United States a couple years ago where the Supreme Court decided that not only could the government take private property for as a matter of eminent domain, for public benefit, you could also take it for private benefit. So if you had some small homes on the lake, on the beautiful riverfront or the lakefront, and some big condo developers wanted to move in and revitalize the neighborhood, the city government could allow that kind of eminent domain. I'm going to say one more thing. I meant to say this at the beginning. I actually have copies of these slides for anybody who want one, so don't wear your hands out taking notes along the way. I'll be happy to give them to you at the end. All right, so you see where this is going. Could we go in and say, as a matter of public benefit, when you die, we are going to take your tissues and organs? Because we have a very long wait list, whatever the actual number is. We have a big wait list, and we're going to come in and take organs and tissues as necessary. Now, I don't know what the tradition here is. In many jurisdictions in the United States, it is possible to take corneas without informed consent of the survivors. So this is changing in some respects because some folks don't like this. Muslims in particular don't like this law where corneas can be taken without even advising the family that it has been done. The benefit of this practice, of course, is that there is no shortage of corneas in the United States. Most jurisdictions, in other words, believe this intervention to be so negligible as to allow it. As I say, some states that is changing. But the principle might be the same. Why not go in and for the victims of motorcycle accidents or car accidents, you take the tissues and organs as necessary as a matter of benefit to the public good. All right. This approach would eliminate the waiting list altogether. I don't think as soon as you caught up with the waiting list, you would probably, thinking entrepreneurially, probably have a surplus of organs and tissues and could perhaps market them outside the world or use them in research and these kinds of things. This would be one way to go. I'm not saying I'm recommending this. I'm just going to give you the options.
Yes, sir. Does anyone do this?
I'm sorry?
Does any country do this?
The only thing that I can think of where I know that this happened was the Soviet Union used to take blood at death. So there would be no shortage of blood in the Soviet Union. That's the closest parallel I know about to this. Right? And they were sort of unsentimental about it. If you're dead, your blood is gone. You no longer need it, and they took it. All right. But it's kind of an alarming prospect, I would guess. Most of you find this, waiting for you to die, and then all of a sudden, in come the physicians, and they say, "Well, let's take those organs, and tissues." Let's look. Yeah.
One more question, out of curiosity. I don't know if England has an organ donor card for your driver's license, but how many people are organ donors?
Oh, here.
Yeah, in the room.
Well, this is typical of most people have not taken steps to become organ donors in places that need them. So,
Can I just clarify, is it uncontroversial that this would solve the problem? Because, for instance, Alpha Matas is one of your eminent surgeons, thinks not. He thinks that live donation is going to be necessary, whatever they procurement is.
I actually think this would do it. I mean, yeah, I think it would. You sometimes get into numbers debates about these kinds of things. But I can see if you take that number, let's roll up to $100,000, 100,000 people, over a 5-year period, I think, or 10-year, depending on what your level, your gauge of success is, you could probably do this. If you want it all at once, no. Because a lot of people, when they die, are not eligible to give organs. They have an HIV infection or something like that. Okay. Another way to go, possibly, would be presumed consent. And this would be a policy in which you let clinicians take organs and tissues unless you specifically take steps to opt out. Right? And most people in the United States, for example, aren't good planners for their own health care. And so this would be punishing the people, not punishing, I don't want to say, the effect of this policy would fall on people who don't take steps to protect themselves from unwanted donation, which would be most people. My taxes are not always paid on time every year. And this would be the similar kind of thing. If you want to protect your organ that's valuable to you, you don't want to donate, you go and take those steps. Otherwise, we're going to step in and take them. Okay. And this is another one where you might want to talk about the numbers a little bit, but it probably would solve it. And the other thing about this policy is that you could do it for any reason, no matter how profound, no matter how trivial. If you don't want your organs and tissues going, you go and you sign out, you fill out a little piece of paper, and that's it. They're protected from involuntary or unwanted donation. All right. This, it seems to me, would also eliminate the waiting list for organs over a period of time. All right. Another issue that may be familiar to some of you thinking about this is the matter of buying and selling organs. At the present, United States law forbids the sale of organs and tissues. Okay, there can be no commercial benefit derived from organs and tissues, so that this trade is, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later, this trade is really, really restricted and has had unintended consequence down the line as well. But suppose we did let people sell kidneys and liver grafts and such, kill them to sell their organs. This doesn't mean you couldn't still also volunteer. So if you wanted to donate, you could still donate. But if you wanted to go to the clinic and offer a kidney for sale, you could also do that as well. Right. Seems to me that this method would also eliminate the waiting list for organs. You'd have the two streams coming on online here. You would have the volunteers, and you'd also have the people who would come forward and say, I'll accept money in exchange for my kidney.
What about hearts and things like that? Would there still be a heart wait list? But also, would you be able to sell it on your deathbed or something like that?
Well, I've limited here to living people. So you can't sell your heart and remain a living person. So, but what about the cadaver death?
Well, otherwise, presumably, there would be a still heart wait list. You couldn't eliminate
that. That's right. But anything you can take from a living donor, let's make it available for sale.
Yeah.
All right. I maybe should have brought the list of how many people are waiting for which organs, but we could go a long way toward, most of the people on that list are kidney, waiting for kidney transplant, the vast majority of them. All right, so you could really drive that list down this way. Okay. All right. Another way to eliminate the wait list would be to ask for volunteers. Please donate your organs, tissues after death. Or ask people to come forward as living donors for kidneys, marrow, liver grafts, etc. This approach has always failed. All right, this is the approach we have right now. Please come forward, please help. And it has always failed. It has never not failed. Let me put it that way. Right? It has never succeeded. Have I made this point in enough variant ways? This has always failed, and yet this is the policy we have. All right? So, the story so far is the United States relies on the approach which has never succeeded in securing sufficient organs and is likely not to do so in the future. It rejects the approaches that would, I think, effectively eliminate waiting lists, eminent domain, presumed consent, and sale of organs and tissues. And I built in a pause here because I knew people would have comments and questions, and there are comments and questions.
Just a yes, sir. Comment that in this country, the voluntary giving of blood has worked.
So what's the difference, is your question?
Oh, no, you said it always fails for donation.
Oh, because technically blood is a tissue. That's correct.
Well, not technically.
Well, it is. It is a tissue. You're right. like the living heart donor, I'm going to leave blood to the side on this discussion. All right. For these particular organs, kidneys, marrow, liver grafts, these kinds of things, we have a system that doesn't succeed.
I thought the UK imported blood from the US, but that's something. I thought Spain succeeded in meeting its
internal needs.
Does he use a presumed consent model? I thought it just actually went aggressively to people to look for donation.
I don't know about Spain's success. Yeah.
I don't think it's actually invented. It's certainly better than anywhere else in Europe, but there's controversy about what the actual cause is.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, if we focus on non-blood, non-heart, there are a lot of organ needs that are going unmet, and I have to tell you, I'm perplexed because I don't see this system succeeding. I don't see it getting any better, just sort of by fine-tuning it. So, I mean, the question, you know, the moral question is, you know, do we want to get serious about this and resolve this, or is this a problem we're sort of willing to accept? And that's not the rhetoric, at least from the transplant medicine, that prevails. The rhetoric coming out of transplant medicine is this is a key problem. We have to solve this one way or the other. It's unacceptable that people are dying on these wait lists. All right. So where am I going to go from here? What I want to do a little bit now is to talk about some mechanisms that are being circulated about getting more organs through the system that's already in place without, you know, going into the buying and selling and those kinds of things. What can we do in terms of these options, one of which is directed donation, and the second is incentives to volunteer. So, now before we go to that, I have to give a little bit of background on donation policies. United Network for Organ Sharing is a federally contracted company. So a company put in a bid to the United States government to be the folks who operate the organ transplant system in the United States, insofar as it depends on federal money. So it's a semi-governmental agency that by and large makes up its own rules. All right. They said, we need this taken care of. They took bids. These guys won the bid. All right. Now, they're operating under federal contract, and they're given a couple of charges, to be equitable, efficient, and effective. So these are the sort of standards that they're held to. Is the company's work meeting these standards? Organs from the dead are, as I mentioned, allocated to regional waiting lists. However, living donors may direct their kidneys, intestines, nerve tissue to specific individuals, usually family members or friends, and this is known as directed donation. So if you die in Chicago and you give your kidneys and your organs for donation, they will go to the top of the waiting list for that region. It used to be called the Organ Bank of Illinois, the Regional Organ Bank of Illinois, which is not a very euphemistic title, and it's now called the Gift of Hope. Right, because I guess it sounds far less clinical and hopefully induce more people to donate. So if you die in Chicago and you give your organs, what will happen is they will go to the waiting list, and they'll take what they can and parse them out according to the waiting list. However, it is also possible to come forward and say, as a living donor, and say, I would like my kidney to go to my sister. And our university hospital instituted a policy of living kidney donors a few years ago. And it's kind of interesting. You want to make sure these folks aren't coming forward or being pushed forward by their family to donate and this kind of stuff. So we actually have a mechanism for evaluating not only their psychosocial eligibility, but also, you know, they met with me as a member of the ethics committee for the hospital, and I went in and I tried to talk them out of it just to see what they would say, you know, just in order, you know, to sort of test the boundaries of why they were doing this. And what I saw was that a son was coming forward to offer part of his liver for his father, who promised afterwards to stop drinking forever. Maybe he will. Maybe he won't. In the meantime, the son who left the military service early in order to do this, wants to keep his dad alive. Or in the other, you know, most of these involve family members. In one case, well, it was a stepfather who was donating to his stepson. And another case, it was an ex-boyfriend who was donating to his girlfriend. She needed a liver graft. And even though they had broken up, they still had remained friends. And had directed, he wanted her to have this opportunity to stay alive. And so he came forward and said, I want you to go forward and give part of my liver to my former girlfriend. Right. And the thing about all these folks have to come to grips with it, of course, is that it may not succeed. It usually does. But there's also a chance of failure. All right. So, I mean, this is something that puts risks on living people, right? Living donors. So, in a way that directed donation does not. It is a peculiarity of the way in which people think, human psychology, that for the past couple of years, more living donors in the United States have come forward as kidney donors than deceased donors. I mean, this is kind of interesting. So, in other words, it's easier to give your kidneys if you know where they're going. You're going to give them to somebody important to you, rather than to say, I would now like to give my kidney to the organ system and improve somebody's life out there somewhere. All right, so for the past couple of years, more organs have come from living donors. I shouldn't say that. More individual donors have come forward. Because dead donors still have two kidneys, you still get more kidneys from dead donors. Right. But in terms of individuals, it's the living donors that now make up the largest numbers of donors of kidneys in the United States.
I'm sorry, I just want to go back a little bit to the heart point. I just, in my case, so once we allow, I don't mean allow in a kind of, I mean kind of more moral philosophical sense, people to take ownership of their own organs and then direct what they want to happen to them when they're still alive, then what is really stopping somebody from saying, well, my life's rubbish, but my heart's really good. You have my heart, you are an eminent neurosurgeon or, you know.
While they're still alive?
While they're still alive, because, you know, I'm, whatever it is.
It's impoverished. It's, in the alcohol and the drug addiction.
All that. Yeah, it's all terrible, but my heart's good. You're successful, eminent, whatever it is. Your life is imminently more beneficial to the world than mine is. Have my heart.
From a sort of practical need here, I think the transplant system would then consider you someone eligible for a heart transplant. And you wouldn't reduce the total number of people needing heart transplants.
But you're not allowed to. Are you allowed to do it in US law? In Britain, and your tradition is the same, there is actually a prohibition on doing certain kinds of harm, even with the consent of the person you're harming.
I don't know of any physician who would do that.
But it's actually illegal.
Okay.
I mean, we actually have a judgment saying the patient may declare his willingness to lay down his life, but the surgeon must not take it at his word.
The German courts were not persuaded, by the way, when the cannibal raised offered the defense of his victim as evidence that it was okay for him to eat the victim.
That's
so
specifically illegal.
Okay. Is that okay? Let me proceed a little bit about this directed donation consideration. At the beginning, the directed donation policies were set up to deal primarily with family members, because at the beginning of transplantation, the closer your immune systems were to one another, the less likely of rejection. So it was, if you had a twin sister or a twin brother, this was the ideal candidate for donation. But what has happened now is that this has expanded to strangers. And there are a few institutions in the United States that don't advertise. They do this passively. I mean, if people have to find out about it and come to them about it. And that is stranger donation. So if you decide in the goodness of your heart that you know there are a lot of people who need kidneys, and well, you have two, you can go forward to a hospital, one of these hospitals, which will find you, which will take your kidney, and then put it, just apply it to the waiting list. So you're not giving it to anyone in particular, you're just giving it to the waiting list. Now, as you imagine, these places attract a certain amount of the lunatic fringe. But they also do find people who simply say, I have two kidneys, I don't need them. I have a summer vacation coming up. Well, I could use that time for recuperation. I'm of sound mind. And people come forward and do this. These are not big numbers, and as I say, the institutions that do this don't advertise it. because they don't want to be seen preying upon people's altruism. But the idea is, if people, there are these people out there who are willing to do it, why not tap into them? Okay. Now, some people want to donate to specific people not known to them personally. For example, in 2003, a basketball player by the name of Alonzo Mourning was announced as needing a kidney. And dozens of fans came forward to volunteer and said, I want to give my kidney to Alonzo Mourning. They had never met him. Maybe they'd seen him on television. Maybe they saw a game in person once or twice. But dozens of people came forward and said, I want my kidney to go to him because I guess he's a good basketball player, and by comparison, my life, not so important. All right. Ultimately, one of his cousins came forward to donate, and an unknown fan was not involved. Now, some people don't want to donate to individuals. They want to donate to groups. In Florida, the state of Florida in 1999, the relatives of murdered Thomas Simon agreed to donate his organs, but only with the stipulation that his organs tissues go to white people only. What's that up there? Why would that be? Well, Simon's a KKK sympathizer. And it turned out that Mr. Simon had been murdered by a black man in a robbery involving $5. So the family was in agreement that he would give, the family agreed to give his tissues and organs on the condition that white people alone get them. All right. The physicians agreed to this, because otherwise they would lose all those valuable tissues and organs. Voice of protest from the back, please.
Sorry, I just want to bring this right back to this idea of the wait list and organ transplants and transplant medicine. And the question is this a good idea? Just fundamentally, that we have a wait list, we have an industry that exists, and of course transplant medicine is going to think that transplant is the way forward. There's an entire industry and profession built on this. But once you've created this, you've created a market that you need, where it's demand and the supply are never going to be equal. And, you know, this idea of that you brought up, this idea of the public good. Well, I mean, I don't know. Is organ transplantation?
Let me hold off on that question, because you're jumping ahead of me a little bit.
I think I've got the slides here.
Yeah.
You can see there's quite a few slides to go before we get through. It's 35.
Okay.
So maybe we should kind of maybe get to the questions at the end.
All right. As you might guess, widespread dissatisfaction followed this decision once it was reported out. And the state of Florida moved to bar donation of this kind of donation by law. And the United Network for Organ Sharing issues the ethical advisory against this kind of discriminatory donation. So in other words, by and large, the dead and the families of the dead do not get to direct where their organs go, particularly to groups, right? However, it hasn't gone away entirely, because directed donation to groups still survives in a number of other ways. Let me introduce you to Zell Kravinsky. Zell Kravinsky is a professor of English literature at the University of Pennsylvania. And through a stroke of accident and good fortune, became a very wealthy man. He bought up some real estate when it was absolutely valueless. It skyrocketed in price, and he started giving it away. And when he got done with giving away his money, he decided he wanted to give away his kidney. And he thought it would be a good idea to give away one of his kidneys to someone who was poor and black in the United States. Oh, poor Zell. He doesn't know anybody who's poor, black, and in need of a kidney. All right. So he goes to a few hospitals in Philadelphia and says, I would like to give my kidney to someone who's poor and black. And he wants to make a donation to a group, right? However, this violates the advisories from UNOS about donating to groups on the basis of racial or other characteristics. So some hospitals simply thank him for stopping by and turn him away. However, one hospital gets a brilliant idea. They introduce him to someone who is poor and black and in need of a kidney. So he now knows someone by name to give the kidney to. He's no longer donating to a group. All right? And at that point, the transplant goes forward. And the woman thanked him. And Zell Kravinsky, rolling on success, decided that, well, what about donating a second kidney? At which point his wife threatened to divorce him. This would be another case where donating a second kidney would not reduce the total number of people waiting for kidneys. So this is not a good idea. All right. Now, as I mentioned, a Philadelphia hospital brokered this deal. So you can say to yourself, well, why not expand this matching service for more potential donors and patients? And that's exactly what this one website, matchingdonors.com, does. It matches people willing to donate to strangers needing transplants. All right, so dating services, transplant services. How does it work? Well, people needing organs post pictures and stories about themselves. It's not free. You have to, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but they're approximately right. You have to pay $295 for a two-month posting or something like this. Or you can pay $700 and your picture stays up there and your story stays up there until you get until somebody comes along and picks you. Right. So it's a commercial service. It's a commercial transplant introduction service is what it is. All right. And strangers surfing the net pick someone they like. They read their story. Medical evaluations are carried out. And the donations go forward if all is medically clear. This is an example. In 2004, Rob Smitty, 32, of Chattanooga, Tennessee, gave a kidney to Bob Hickey, 58, of Edwards, Colorado. Right. These are utter strangers to one another. And Rob Smitty on the right here decided he was going to donate a kidney, went online, shopped the catalog until he decided this was the guy. Right. Here's another example. This one really puzzles me. Bob Strzuski gave a kidney to Josh Pleasance, who's 15. Bob is 38 and the father of five. So one night after the kids were asleep, he went into the kitchen and said, "Dear, I know we've got five children, but I'd like to give a kidney to someone, to a complete stranger." And he did. All right. So now the interesting thing about this is, I mean, this looks like individuals giving to specific individuals. I mean, I think the sort of background skeptical question to have is whether what you have here is individuals giving to groups. I mean, people picking the groups that they identify with some reason or another and picking that individual out. Okay? Now, it seems to me, here's some arguments from me. This kind of solicitation seems to me a mistake for the following reasons. First of all, the site gives some people on the waiting list an advantage over the others, the vast majority of whom are not on the site. The people on this matchingdonors.com are a tiny fraction of the total people waiting for transplant organs. All right. Now, I would have less problem with a catalog like this if it were complete, if everybody who wanted to be on there were on there, and that potential donors could see everybody and choose. But the United Network for UNOS won't build a site for people like this. It declined to do so, saying we don't have the resources to do it. And I'm fairly skeptical because they have almost hour to hour updates on the folks here. They have complete lists of all those candidates. They can identify them to themselves. I think they could certainly offer them the option. I don't think everyone would take it. But anyways, they said we're not going to do this. All right. So it's only a small fraction of people who get this benefit. In other words. So the vast majority of people remain invisible to the potentially donating public. All right. And I also think, this is the other side of it, I think if the complete lists are there, it would probably increase the total number of people coming forward to donate this way. All right. So right now you have this kind of niche activity that most people don't know about. And it does, I don't know what their total success rate is. I don't know how many people who sign up and how many actually get organs. But I do know that people donate this way, and they advertise that. All right. Now, here's another question. It seems to me that depending on how you present yourself, sympathetic patients might get the advantage here. And I worry about this in particular in relation to my own life. Suppose I needed a kidney. I've gone to this website and I looked around and I said, how would I stack up compared to the other people on this site? You know, how would I look sympathetic-wise? I'm not so sure. Anybody who's, you know, 17 or 18 or 12 and cuter than me, I think is always going to win over me. All right. So I sort of wonder about the advantages that folks get on here because of the way they present themselves. All right. The other thing that I think is maybe a danger here is that this alternative may undercut stranger donations. You can already give your kidney to somebody who needs it. There's no obstacle to that. So if you have this alternative system, it seems to me it may be bleeding off recipient or donors from the stranger donation policies as well. Onward here. Okay. Another approach would be the life sharer approach. This is a very aggressive group. These folks mean business. They want you to join this group, and it works this way. It's a club. Their sole purpose is to donate organs and tissues to other club members. All right, that's it. Now, how does that work? Well, when you die, you agree that your organs will be offered first to members of life sharers. So the idea would be the hospitals would canvass to see whether or not anybody's eligible and needs that organ in the club. And if so, it goes to them. And if nobody needs it at the moment, it goes to the UNOS waiting list. It goes to the regional waiting list. All right. The idea here is to get people to act on their own self-interest. What's the idea? The idea here is to increase the likelihood of getting an organ by joining a club whose purpose is to give you organs if you need them and if they can. So it's a members first, and then everybody else gets a crack at the organs. All right? I've covered this a little bit. In theory, lots of people will join out of self-interest, and parents may enroll their children as well. So literally, anybody can join. Okay. And as I said, I've jumped ahead on this. All right. This seems to me a mistaken approach too. I don't think UNOS should work with life sharers for these reasons. The first thing that comes to my mind here is this approach ignores the quality of matches. Some donations would waste organs. So in other words, the transplantation occurs almost independent, would occur independent of medical facts. You're the member, you get it first. No matter what your life expectancy is, no matter how long you've been waiting. Suppose you just became a member yesterday. Okay, right? You would get those organs. As long as you're in the club, you get first crack at them. Right. So in other words, my hesitance here is that the decisions being made here don't take all people needing organs into consideration, and they don't take medical facts into consideration as well. Another oddity about this approach is that some people in life sharers are medically ineligible to donate. You can have an HIV infection, for example, and still belong to this group. So you can't donate your organs, but you can get them back. So this is an oddity. The other thing, this is perhaps the practical problem, I think totally undermines this. Suppose we do this. Suppose we say, yeah, we're going to do this. If that happened, then I think every transplant physician would say to his or her patients, join this club. At which point, the membership would look like the regional waiting list that we already have. Okay. All right, now, a variant on this is the sort of preferred customer, not the private club approach, but the preferred customer approach. And that is this idea, that if you agree to donate your organs at death, you get preferred status if you need an organ before then. And in practice, what this means is that you get points that move you up the waiting list. So those of you who had raised your hands earlier saying you had taken steps to donate your organs and tissues after death, all other things being equal, you would get preference over somebody who hasn't done that. This is not decisive by itself, but it gives you some points that move you up the waiting list. Right, and this, the idea here would be, again, self-interest. What's your best opportunity to get organs in the case you need them? Sign up to donate to others upon your death. Okay. Some folks, when they're talking about this, say, why should people who have taken no steps to get organs and tissues, have taken no steps to donate organs and tissues, have the same eligibility status as those who have? That's the logic here, creating an incentive to donate. This is an approach that's under discussion by academics and the United Network for Organ Share in the United States. I'm a little skeptical about it because it's unclear to me how much of an impact this would have. First of all, it requires prior planning, and most Americans are not good at this. Most Americans, 85%, do not have advanced directives for healthcare. So 85% of the population has not said, I would like this to happen at when my time comes to die. This is not a moral argument, this is a practical argument, but you're asking people to make plans for advanced plans for healthcare. Most people just are psychologically equipped to do this. I think there are probably ways to improve that. You could, a time of insurance and these kinds of things. You'd ask people to fill out these forms. You'd probably get a greater compliance. But as it is, most people don't make this kind of advanced planning, which is another way of saying that I don't think that this is going to bring that many more volunteers forward. And I also think that this policy would put people at a disadvantage if they choose not to donate for religious reasons. There are some Jewish interpreters, for example, who don't accept the criterion of brain death as decisive, and therefore decline to donate tissues and organs at a declaration of brain death because they're not persuaded absolutely that people are dead. And so rather be complicit in any mutilation of a human person, they decline not to donate. For these folks, this kind of advantage that would be an advantage they couldn't opt into. All right. We are moving along here. So bear with me. Other financial incentives to increase donation. There are a variety of these have been proposed. Pay some portion of the funeral cost. So you offer, a nominal sum, $1,000, $1,500 toward funeral costs if you agree to donate. Or a reduction in health insurance costs for live donors, a tax break, a deduction on your annual taxes, or a contribution to the donor's name charity. So if you donate, the hospital will donate $500 toward your favorite charity or something like this. The one key thing here is that these, they not only run up against the presumption of altruism, but conservative interpretations of the law hold that they probably violate the law banning the sale of organs and tissues. So you can't give somebody a check for an organ, and you also can't give somebody's estate a check for an organ because it looks like a sale. So these kind of proposals haven't gone very far past the talking stage.
Question?
Yeah.
So if I'm in a motorcycle accident, they harvest my organs, is there a medical way of disposing of the body? Or does in the United States you have to get buried in a $5,000 funeral?
I understand what you've said, but I don't understand the question, if I can put it that way.
How does it work?
Oh, I mean...
So is it typical after a...
Oh, just in general? I mean, if you're identified, your next of kin will presumably take care of you as they want to understand you.
So after the organs get harvested...
Oh, after. Yeah, after. It all falls on the family. It all falls on the family, right? Okay, so the idea would be just turn around and offer the family a check as a nominal fee, but again, the conservative interpretation, the state attorneys general don't like this because they don't want to go into court about this, so they're just going to leave it alone. Okay. All right. So where can we go from here? One of the things that we can do is to educate in order to increase the number of volunteers. That's beautiful. But educational effects really don't seem to move the numbers very much. It might make a difference if you had some strong opinion leaders in a country do this. I'm being skeptical about this, and I don't think so, things are written in stone here. But if you had some strong national leadership where visible leaders, governors of states, the president of the United States, American Medical Association leaders, made this a strong point, I think you could probably move the numbers. But this doesn't happen. Everybody sort of pays lip service to it, but there's sort of no movement on the part of national opinion leaders to place this at the top of medical healthcare priorities in the United States. All right. As I mentioned, living kidney donors exceed deceased donors in recent years. Yep, I'm getting ahead of myself here. Let me revisit the alternatives a little bit at the end. Eminent domain, we go in and we take the organs and tissues at point of death. I think this is, first of all, politically unfeasible. I can't see anybody anybody elected to the Congress, to the government, on the basis of this. Elect me, and I will take your organs and tissues at death. I mean, it's just a political non-starter. All right. So that's the political side of it. The morally problematic side about it sort of preempts an important choice about disposition of remains. I think you'd have to have a long national searching discussion about this before you could implement some version of it. And I don't have any crystal ball about this, but it seems to me this is just not in the political cards. The other way to go here is presumed consent. It would be a politically unattractive way, it seems to me, and presumptuous to take care of a small fraction of the people needing life-saving health care. In other words, people needing organs and tissues are a fraction of the total people in the United States needing health care. And it seems morally presumptuous to me to say, out of all the people needing health care in the United States, we're going to take these steps to take care of these folks and let everybody else fend for themselves. All right, so it's a sort of consistency argument. More volunteers, well, fine-tuning the current system and likely to change the numbers and propose mechanisms work to favor some people over others, and for reasons that I've said, I think that's unfair. That leaves us with the last argument, the last possibility here, the financial incentives. This is maybe what I'd like to open for discussion here, maybe the idea of a regulated market. Would it be possible to have some kind of regulated market here, where you do have exchange, quid pro quo exchanges of financial value for organs? All right. And sort of the background consideration that sort of impresses me on this matter is that physicians, hospitals, insurers profit from organ transplant. Everybody involved in transplantation gets a check when it's done, except for the donors. So, consistency, you ask yourself, why should the donors be left out? The question I think I'd like to talk about here is whether you could regulate this by way of statute and reimbursement reinsurance rates. I mean, you just only let the free market decide, but you sort of cap it, you regulate it, so you don't have some kind of wild fluctuations. Moreover, sort of the numbers actually work to keep the potential to the possibility of exploitation low. And that would be was that too loaded a word? To avoid exploitation of sellers of tissues.
But if you keep the prices low, that's what most people would say was exploitation.
Oh, I see. Well, let me give you some numbers such as I've been able to find them. The sort of background in terms of the market, you have to think about supply and demand. And if you think of potential organ sellers in the United States as being, you know, in excess of 301 million times two kidneys each, that's a potential, that's a big supply. Of course, you have to take away the folks who are too young and too old, then you take away the folks who are too sick, and the others who are unable to donate, and compare that to the fixed need. There are about 76,000 waiting list candidates. What the actual number is, remember, is not clear. But so you have a very small fixed need relative to the total population of potential supply. Now, there are some numbers on how much people get for kidneys when they do involve sales. There was one study reporting that illegal kidney sales in India were netting people about 770 pounds. Another study in Pakistan was a little more sophisticated. It reported a mean of about 918 pounds with a high range of 131 above that, 131 pounds below that. All right. And then after expenses, because you've got some brokers reaching the hand and, you know, taking a share of that money as well, 10% for the commissioner and this kind of thing, this article reported that people were getting about 688 pounds for a kidney. And one U.S. estimate that I heard that I don't actually have a reference for, because I went to a talk and an economist hypothesized about this and didn't publish the article, but he sort of talked about it. He said that between 750 and 850 pounds would be the amount that you could probably get for your kidney. All right. So these are not life-changing numbers.
Sorry, but those are numbers of people in much poorer parts of the world, right? So 900 pounds here is not a huge amount. 900 pounds in Pakistan is probably a very, you know, significant incentive for somebody to consider an organ that they don't see and doesn't really do much for them.
I jumped ahead of myself when I called these not life-changing amounts, didn't I? I promise to come back to that. What I meant to show, was these numbers are to show that it's hard to command a very large number for a kidney. It's the supply is too big. It works against that kind of a thing. All right. In one case, I don't have it on here, but the Iranian government stepped in and guaranteed a price to kidney sellers because the middlemen, the brokers, were taking too big of a share. So the Iranian government decided kidney sellers were getting screwed and, you know, guaranteed them a certain amount. And it was roughly in this range. Okay. All right. Let's take a little philosophical tour of this organ selling issue. The objections fall into two main categories. The first is that there's something inherently objectionable about this, about commodifying body parts this way, because of what they mean to self as self. I mean, there's some inherent value to your possession or not selling your kidneys, and you should never transgress that rule. The second effect is that there are all kinds of dire social consequences that come along, and for that reason, we don't want to head down this particular slippery slope. Okay. So when I look at this, the argument that this is inherently objectionable, I'm not fully persuaded. And I'm not persuaded because it seems to me that this selling of a kidney, to use that example, does not involve the loss of any fundamental human capacity or represent a risk without parallel elsewhere in life. I don't think it incapacitates people. I don't think it incapacitates their relationships. I think it's hard to make the case that there's something inherently wrong with this, that it is different in kind than the other commercial transactions in which our lives take place. All right. And I also don't think that it's inherently wrong to face risk that contribute to one's own good and to the social good at the same time. So I'm not persuaded that there's something inherently wrong with doing this. So that means if we're going to object to this, we have to object to it on the consequentialist grounds and say this leads to all kinds of unhappy outcomes, so let's not do it. So we can talk about that. Is this too risky? Well, it's when carried out under good clinical conditions, it's not too risky. Because the risks of these interventions are known and therefore in principle controllable. It seems to me very difficult to make the case that the risks are unacceptable for living kidney sellers, but not for living kidney donors. In other words, the risk theoretically would be the same, whether you're selling or whether you're donating. All right? I don't think that you can just walk into this blind. I think you would need a lot of rigorous screening in any case to make sure that people are giving for good, solid reasons. Now, here's the exploitation argument. If you did this, who would sell their organs? And I have to tell you, I've thought about this a lot, and it seems to me in the United States, the people who would sell their organs are these people. People who are not necessarily poor. They're probably employed, but they probably have a lot of credit card debt. All right. That seems to me a likely pool of folks who would come forward and say, my credit card debt is really racked up here, therefore what I'd like to do is go and sell my kidney and apply that money and at least try to get under, yes.
I would say that the most likely candidate is a student trying to pay tuition. Another pool
would be students, and I'm not sure they would apply that money to tuition, because you mentioned they were students, but for the summer vacation or this kind of thing, the trip to Mexico or wherever. So I think there are sort of groups that would be much more likely to do this than other. I think that, you know, busy executives with full-time jobs and this kind of stuff would not likely do this. But I also think that some of the people we saw earlier who donated their kidneys might be willing to sell them too. I mean, they came forward for no reason to do this. Those people would be probably just as likely to come forward to do this. In any case, I mean, you can't know exactly who's going to come forward and do this. But it seems to me that you could have professional advisors address the actual amounts involved, as is in fact done with compensation to egg donors now. Fertility medicine groups have very specific numbers about how much egg donors should get. They're trying to walk this line between not exploiting people by paying too little and not offering an undue inducement by paying too much. So, for example, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine says that egg donors, women who come forward as egg donors, should get no more than between $5,000 and $10,000 for their efforts. The interesting fact that happened after that recommendation last fall is that most clinics raised the amount of money they offered because they've been offering lower amounts than that. Yeah.
With regards to this, let's say we turn this into a regulated market, 27, and I sell my kidney, and at this moment everything looks fine. 10 years down the line, something happens, and I now have disease in the other kidney, and had I had another kidney,
yes,
I would have been okay. Who's responsible? Like, is there any, or is it, no, you took the risk, you decided to sell your kidney, you couldn't have known.
Right now it's all assumption of risk.
Okay.
On the part of the individual. But you wanted to interject that kidney diseases.
On the whole, kidney disease gets both kidneys. If either, it would have to be a freak accident that just knocked out one kidney and not the other. And if we're talking about a regulated market, it could be part of the deal that you had insurance against them.
Right. But, yeah. But since we don't have the market yet, it's hard to know exactly what features
you could
build it in.
You could
build that in. That's right. That's right. Or not. All right. Now, here, one, in regards to what happens to people after they sell their organs. There was one widely discussed study from the Journal of the American Medical Association that showed that the lives of Indian vendors were not materially better off after selling their kidneys. And this was a case where they were given a chunk of money that looked to them like a big chunk of money, and they enjoyed having that money, and the researchers went back to them a few years later and asked them if their lives were materially better off, and the answers they reported were typically no. And in some cases they alleged their health had deteriorated. There's a lot of discussion about this article, and I think what that article, and the authors were very sympathetic to the idea that this was evidence against selling organs. I think you could interpret it a different way. I think this is evidence of the difficulty of improving the lives of poor people by giving them one-time lump sum of cash. So, and there are some folks that are very difficult to help, and giving them giving them lottery winnings or something like this may not materially help their lives. So I'm not persuaded that this particular study showed that we should never do this as well. The other thing that the study couldn't couldn't report, couldn't find out of it, what these people's lives would have been like had they not gotten even that injection of cash. In any case, on a philosophical level, it's hard to say that someone should only be able to sell something if his life would be materially better off and lead to improved health afterwards. This is a sort of very high standard. So it seems to me that if consequentialist arguments are going to succeed, they would have to show that organ sales, there are the following elements. There are systemic health risks to donors in general. I mean, there's something about the procedure that is just bad for people routinely. Or every once in a while, it's generally safe, but every once in a while something catastrophic comes along. And that the seller's lives are made worse in a causally related way by the sale or the surgery and the money. Okay? And or that there's a damaging social effect that could not be otherwise contained except through barring sales. Conclusions. There is, it seems to me, a permanent crisis in transplant medicine. If the law and policy continue on the present course, there is no foreseeable end to the waiting lists. Without some change, people will continue to die waiting for transplants. Approaches involving selective internet solicitation and a members first club are unsatisfactory, as I see them. Let's at least discuss a regulated market in organs and tissues. For the reasons that I'm not persuaded that organ selling is inherently wrong if you do it in a regulated way. Now, the last thing I will say is that this position does not depend on the fact that there is a large wait list. I mean, if the wait lists were smaller, I might be persuaded of these things as well. Although the large numbers on this list does add some urgency to the matter. So, with that, I'm done.
Okay. Questions? Toby, Steve, Franz?
I think that I agree with you that that this organ market would probably be better than the status quo situation that we're in. But with what it seems to me is that that presumed consent would be better again. So there's several questions as to which is the best system and whether a given system is better than the status quo. And there's also a separate question about how realistic it is. I would think that presumed consent is actually also more realistic, at least in the UK, than getting an organ market. That there'd be less anguish about that. But the reason that I think that this particularly would be better than this idea of the market is that with the market, there's still organ donation happening from living people who
right.
don't have to
and
bear
dead.
A burden.
And dead.
Now, that's true. However, to get the same number of organs, if some of them come from living people, there's a higher burden that's born than if they're all coming from dead people who don't actually bear much of a burden from losing an organ, if anything. So, the nice thing about presumed consent
yeah.
is that it all comes from dead people. So it seems that that's just going to be better overall for the population of the country. And you were concerned that people are bad about making decisions for their future, and so therefore they might kind of not want to give organs but can't be bothered sending in a letter or ticking a form when they get their
yes.
driving license or something. Even if it's just below the bit where you have to sign and said, please tick this box if you don't give it. You could make it very easy. Whereas you do think that people could accurately judge the amount of money that they would require in order to outweigh the cost to them of organ donation, when it seems that these people in India would actually now say, or wherever the survey was, would say, actually we might have got that number wrong, because it's very difficult to know about what it's like for the next 30, 40 years of my life and how this is going to affect me. That seems to be a much harder decision to get right than the one you need for the presumed consent, which is just to tick a box if you bother.
Your remarks make me think of a lot of things. I think the one thing I would like to say about the United States is there are people in the United States who have never spoken a word of English, who in the entirety of their lives speak Navajo and this kind of thing. So what I worry about in their presumed consent is also the informed consent part of that. So I think that, I understand what you're saying, that presumed consent might be the better way to go because you're dealing with dead bodies and therefore there's no risk to living donors and those kinds of things. But I'm not persuaded that you can get the degree of informed consent required.
I think the name presumed consent is a misnomer. It should be called opt-out or something like that. I don't think that
the presumed consent is consent.
Let me reformulate and say I'm not sure that I would be comfortable with the degree of informed consent you would be getting from people in the system if it were implemented because of the linguistic and cultural barriers. Okay. And for me, that would count as a moral reason.
But what if you just modified?
Which would not be true for the people selling their organs. Because there you have them right in front of you. You don't have to hypothesize about what's going through their mind and what they want. They volunteer to come forward, and you can have the informed consent right there in front of you.
I agree with that.
Yep. Can we go back to internet solicitation?
Yes.
Because I didn't really understand maybe there were several problems. I didn't understand how this could be worse than the current situation. So that's one thing. The second thing is, one particular thing you said, you talked about it would be somehow bad if people chose cute people and decided they wished to donate their organs to someone for...
rather than me.
Rather than someone who was lacking in cuteness or whatever.
Sympathy.
Whatever the property is. And I just didn't understand this at all. I don't see what's wrong with deciding to donate your organs to a person. I mean, it just seems to be one sort of variable. It might be a legitimate one.
Here's the background in this. The transplant folks have argued consistently against using the media for specific solicitation for an individual. In the past, this has meant taking your child on television and pleading for a donor for that child. Because, in point of fact, there are lots of children just like that child in that same regional waiting area eligible for the list as well. So they shied away from that. My objection to the internet solicitation is not one in principle, it's because not everybody is there. That's part one. If there were a complete catalog, I think that would be far superior to what's available now. Because to me right now, this matchingdonors.com, which you have to pay for, looks like taking your kid down to the local television station or newspaper and sort of special pleading for this child is somehow more important than the other folks on the waiting list.
But if we had a complete catalog, you wouldn't have a problem with someone picking the cute people.
Now, the second part is this. I worry that... donating to the complete catalog isn't donating to groups in a way that the advisories object to, namely by race. I mean, you could get Thomas Simon donating by internet to white people only, and nobody would ever know that. Now, the tricky part about this is some folks believe that you could probably increase the total number of donations if you let people donate to groups. And I think there's some kind of intuitive truth to this. For example, I do assume that people tend to favor the sympathetic characters that, you know, as they interpret it. But I also think that there are people who would go to the hard luck cases too, namely the military veteran who now needs a second liver transplant because of all the bad war experiences and the alcoholism and this kind of thing. So, I mean, I don't know how to estimate this. If you could give to complete strangers, or if you could give to a group that you identify and you pick out, which are you more likely to give to? So it might be, and we couldn't know this until we actually did it, if you let people donate to groups, whether that would increase the donation rate. So on that part of it, I don't like the fact that this internet donation can hide objectionable motives. But it might well be that if you let black people donate to black people only and white people to donate to white people only, that you might raise the total amount of donation overall.
All right. Two questions interrelated to this matching donors site. Is it possible on the matching donor site to search specifically for groups? I want everyone living in Kansas, or I want only white people between the age of 35 and 40.
Oh, I don't remember what the search mechanisms are.
But there are search mechanisms.
There probably are, yeah. Male or female. I would have to look at that.
Yeah, probably age or something. You can separate them into groups. It's just you might not possibly separate them into...
There
objectionable groups.
Yeah. I have done nothing more than page through them. So I don't remember the mechanisms offhand.
And number two, if you specify groups, for instance, I only wish to donate to left-handed artists living in a certain part of the United States in a certain age band, wouldn't I be introducing large transaction costs into the donation system?
Yeah. This is another feature. How finely grained do you want these groups to be drawn? For example, if you're a conservative, do you want to donate only to conservatives, or Democrats or Republicans, or virgins until you're 21? These kinds of things. I mean, once you sort of introduce the idea of group donation, why can't all groups be eligible in the same way that charitable groups are eligible for your dollar donation, to Native Americans only, or disabled veterans, or these kinds of things. That seems to me to be introducing. It's hard for me to see a way to say yes to one group without there's no way to limit this. In other words, so I worry about the practical effect of doing that, which might dilute down the road any possible benefit of allowing people to donate to groups. Again, this is sort of speculative.
Right, we've got one there,
then
one there. So that's the order.
I was somewhat curious about your statement about what would fix the shortage and what wouldn't fix it. I think we can agree that what won't solve the problem. We have a lot of empirical evidence of that. I'm just skeptical that the other approaches might fix the shortage. In the kidney example, it might be possible. I think your numeric example is pretty good. But it might be many other kinds of donations where it's unlikely, and actually we're just going to see the demand go up. So until we can make new hearts, we're not going to be able to fill it.
Hearts again, yeah. That's why I stuck with living, living donors. On the other, marrow donors, there are frontiers of transplantation that will create new opportunities. I'm not sure that I would want to say at the very beginning either that we should have a market in all of these. For nerve tissue donation, for example, our hospital carried out nerve tissue donation from a mother to her child. In that particular case, you have the mother's sympathy and interest in the child being a sex factor. Until that kind of transplantation gets a lot better, I'm not sure I would also say that that automatically ought to be a market-regulated process at the beginning either. So it may be that some of these novel transplantation techniques won't be solvable even by the other mechanisms right away either. So, okay.
Judge, next one.
Yeah, so I guess my question is, in the United States, at least in Maryland, when you get your driver's license, there's a box.
Yes.
Would you like to be a good organ donor? You check it off. The cost associated with doing that are zero if you have a driver's license, and most people do. So the question, and kind of in the...
And most people don't check, yes.
And the question I would have is why? What are the underlying problems?
Yeah.
If you're going to focus education... Why are people not checking what seems like a completely inconsequential box that could drastically help someone else? Is there any? I mean, I've heard anecdotal stories.
No, I once put this. I had a small group of medical students, and I decided one little activity for them is to learn how to write. Medical students, by and large, don't write kind of articles for public consumption. So I asked them to write an essay for the op-ed pages of the newspaper, and I was going to break them up into those who had taken steps to donate their organs and those who hadn't. And it was about 50-50. And I'll tell you, I mean, I thought if anybody, I was quite surprised by the number of medical students who had not taken steps to donate their organs. And, let's use them as a focus group. One said, and I'm just paraphrasing them, neutrally, I'm not trying to pass judgment on them. One said that she would like to donate her organs, but she hadn't talked to her family about it yet, and she didn't want it to be a surprise. So until she had a discussion with her family, she wouldn't want them to find out in the emergency room of the hospital where the transplant officer comes forward and asks for permission, those kinds of things. Another one, this was a case, another was an Orthodox Jew who said, I don't accept brain death as a criterion of death, and therefore I'm opting out of the whole system. You know, I'll be happy to take organs, but you know, please don't take mine. The one that was sort of most memorable was the woman who would believe that her father had been denied eligibility for a transplant of his liver because of his perceived alcoholism. And she believed that he should have gotten that transplant, and she was so angry that he did not, and therefore died, that she was never going to contribute back to the system. So there are all kinds of reasons why people choose not to take these steps to donate their organs. The other thing that I'll mention, this is fascinating legal sociology in its own right. For people in the United States with their driver's licenses and ID cards, where they made an indication, made a declaration that they want to donate or not donate. The culture of hospitals, when presented with a dead patient who has declared an interest in donating his or her organs, they will go also to the family and ask permission. And if the family says no, most hospitals will accept that as the final decision. Now, because the physicians don't want to send away an unhappy family. So in a couple of cases in the state of Texas and in the state of Illinois, the state legislature has passed law to specifically protect physicians against legal recriminations if they honor the wishes declared on the driver's license in regard to organ donation. So this theoretically gives them the power to go against the family wishes, but in many cases they don't. So it's not only the public, it's also the clinical practitioners who are also having some second thoughts about this.
Thank you, Alex.
Yeah, two quick questions. Professor, I'm sorry, I know that you stuck to kidneys, but I really want to push you on some of the other things.
Okay.
So the one is if we turn it into a regulated market, are we not kind of at a high level, are we not talking about financial incentives? Like, what are the levels of financial incentive we accept to risk on human life? So how far is it until we say, all right, we need to try a new HIV vaccine, we need a challenge study, how much money can we give you to take on the risk that if I injected you with the vaccine and exposed you in a controlled way, that you would become infected? You know, and I think there is, like, there would be a number on that. It's probably not as much as I imagine it would be, but this, I kind of, are we not talking about how much risk would you take and how much is it worth to you now? And then you inherently have problems with it, kind of.
For me, you're asking a variant of the slippery economic slope question. Namely, once we proceed to take the step, how do we retain a secure foothold relative to other risks that we might want people to accept? For me, the controlling limitation here is the fact of this parallel living kidney donation, which we ask people to do all the time and expect that they get nothing in return. So for me, that would be a kind of conceptual boundary where the HIV exposure study doesn't have that kind of parallel. So I would say that's an unacceptable assumption of risk for any amount of money relative to the possibility of a lethal outcome.
And then the same one slightly related to that. Would it make a difference if this were visible? So instead of it with the kidney, so you're a donor, you get left with a scar. But if it was a hand, let's say I'm right-handed and my hand gets chopped off, and I also happen to be like a piano virtuoso, and it'd be really useful if I had another right hand, and somebody was like, well, I'm left-handed, so here you can, and the transplantation is such, you can have it. I mean, would it make a difference? And I'm thinking more, I know that's quite out there, but I'm thinking more of kind of living lung, so you take a half a lung, or corneas, right, where you could conceivably give your one cornea and live quite happy without it. And then are we not asking the medical profession to now step in and make judgments about what is an acceptable quality of life? And is that really where those decisions should be made.
Well, I admire the altruism that's behind all your examples where people's lives are made they're not made fundamentally better, are they? They're retained at the very high level of functioning. And that they all presume a certain amount of altruism. But for me, another limiting factor would be, if we're talking about hands, I guess, or corneas, would be the limiting function on the individual. And in that case, it would seem to me, you could not make the case, as you could for kidneys, that somebody retains the same level of functionality after the donation. And therefore, that's another boundary.
Can I ask the last question? So the preferred customer, where if you agree to donate, you go up the waiting list. You said there were the two objections to that as a viable model. So one is that people aren't very good at prior planning.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to be a very good objection.
Yeah.
People don't take out pensions, or they don't take out retirements. We don't think, well, that's a sort of reason to protect them. I mean, people are left to their own rationality. And indeed, advance directives are typically to do with things at the end of life, whereas this would be something that would be life-saving. So to expect the incentives to take part in this would be much greater. But the main one I wanted to concentrate on was this. Some people don't want to donate for religious reasons.
Yeah.
This approach would put them at a disadvantage. Well, certainly would put them at a disadvantage. The question is it unfair that they're put at a disadvantage? It doesn't strike me as being unfair at all. I mean, if I have a religious objection to paying taxes, fine, I could go away and live on an island and practice my religion and live how I wanted to. But we don't think you should be able to be exempt from paying taxes and benefiting from everyone else's taxation because you have religious objections. This just is yet another example of the way in which we discriminate in favour of people. I mean, if you're a Jehovah's Witness, you can get more expensive blood alternatives, avoid transfusion, the risk associated with transfusion, because you claim a religious reason. I think this is precisely wrong because it discriminates against those of us who agree to contribute and gives special privilege to religious people, drawing on a pool that we're all contributing to. So I think there would be an argument in favour of having a preferred
I will accept the unfair, the criticism, and sort of backtrack by saying that I don't think it's very unfair. The advantage of this preferred customer approach is that it doesn't.
It's unfair that they get to draw on the pool but aren't prepared to contribute. Yeah. That's
really
what's unfair.
Actively unfair.
So it seems that this is correct.
All right. And to add to your criticism of me, let me also say that it doesn't remove them from the list either. So it's not like they're off the list. It's just they're just not at the top of the list for that kind of thing. So I don't know. I'm still a little hesitant about it. I probably think it's a good idea, maybe not yet, because if you have something that gives people an incentive to come forward and protect their own interests, you're right. It's not necessarily unfair if people don't do that for themselves. All right. I'm not sure the playing field is level on this. And even though you said you wanted to ask the last question, I would like to ask the last question of myself, if I may. The one thing that is sort of unclear to me about this is how we need to think about this as a crisis. I call this a transplantation crisis. The one thing that almost never enters into these discussions is the status of people on the list. How do they get there? In other domains, you see discussions of people's right to health care depending upon how they got to that condition, whether it's self-incurred, did they do something through their drug and alcohol behavior that got them there. The one thing that has not happened with the transplant list that has happened in other discussions with smokers, for example, is that there's a presumption that all of this need is first order health care need. And I'm just sort of wondering out loud whether or not if we applied this lens of personal responsibility for the effect, whether we might not, where we would rank this transplant crisis relative to other healthcare needs. So looking at this in isolation, it looks like a bad thing. I'm not persuaded necessarily that this is the worst healthcare problem in all of the healthcare problems that there are. So that actually came more of a statement than a question.
Sorry, you've been talked there. You've still got questions pressuring at the end, so thank you for a very comprehensive overview of the alternatives. I've never heard anything that's quite capital and there's different options.
All the waterfront.
So, yeah, I didn't hear your stem cells, though. That's a topic for a little time. Thank you very much.
So it seems like the market for eggs is also